Mendino's Cabinets. The local pro.
Mendino's Cabinets in Anderson designs custom kitchens, bathrooms, and offices that no big box store can match. They are the local pros who know.
Mendino's Cabinets. The local pros who know. Mendino's Cabinets. The local pros.
530-365-8108 or visit mandinascabinets.com.
Join Aaron and Bill for We the People Radio, Sundays, noon until 2.
It's conservative talk radio with a liberal dose of humor. Get the whole story from experts around the world delivering facts rather than opinion.
Missed a show? Busy at noon? No problem. Listen to our free archives when you have time. No commercial interruptions or download restrictions. We the People Radio.
.us.
From the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
The country had never seen anything like this, the idea that the presidency of the United States is going to be litigated to determine who gets to be president, and moreover, that it's going to be decided on the basis of a number of votes, the same number of people that could be fit inside a Texas Roadhouse on a Friday night.
This is your host, Scott Bertram. Welcome to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, part of the Hillsdale College Podcast Network. That was James Rosen, author of the new book, Scalia, Supreme Court Years 1986 to 2001. We'll go in depth with James about this great biography of Antonin Scalia. Also, later on in today's program, Dr. Matt Meehan from Hillsdale in D.C. will talk about restoring America's founding imagination. First, we're joined by James Rosen, the great chief Washington correspondent at Newsmax. You can find him on X at James Rosen TV, and he has a new book out, the second in a trilogy on the life and legacy of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. The first book was Scalia, Rise to Greatness. The new one is Scalia, Supreme Court Years 1986 through 2001. James, thanks so much for joining us again.
Scott, it's an honor to be back with you and all my friends at Hillsdale.
People can go back into our archives, find our conversation about the first book if they wish, but you can jump right into book two if you want. Early in this new book, James, you have a quote from an acquaintance of Antonin Scalia, who says, "At Main Justice, he did damn near everything, and he did it well." So book two starts the Supreme Court years. At this stage in his life, at this stage in his professional career, how does Antonin Scalia continue performing at a high level? How does he keep his skills sharp?
Well, Scott, first of all, thanks again for having me. This new volume, Volume 2, Scalia's Supreme Court Years, 1986 to 2001, covers the first half of Justice Scalia's nearly 30 terms on the Supreme Court, and it ends roughly at the halfway point with the completion of the national trauma of the case of Bush v. Gore, which decided the 2000 presidential election. There is some material at the very beginning of the book about Justice Scalia's first days on the Supreme Court. And in fact, the entire book begins with a quote from Justice Scalia's wife, Maureen Scalia, who made tremendous sacrifices in order for him to reach the pinnacle of his profession. And I had asked her in an email exchange in 2024 whether he was nervous when he first began, etc. And the very opening quote that you'll see in the book, the front epigraph, it's Mrs. Scalia saying, in essence, that right before he went into his first conference with the other justices, he thanked her. He expressed his gratitude to God. There was some expression on the part of the justice of uncertainty as to whether he was up to this, but then he headed straight in. And I found previously unpublished letters written by Justice Scalia in those early days on the Supreme Court to priests, in fact, where he asked them, please pray for me. And in another instance, he disclosed to somebody he was writing to that he feared that he was already at that point, at the dawn of this extraordinary tenure on the Supreme Court, which had such a momentous impact on American law, society, and history. He feared that he was running on the basis of fumes intellectually, on the basis of intellectual energies already expended, in essence, that he might have run out of gas. And this was just as he was beginning this extraordinary and historic tenure. So there was humility. But I would tell you, Scott, that the very qualities and attributes that propelled Scalia to the pinnacle of his profession, to the marble temple of the Supreme Court, were the same qualities that enabled him to thrive and succeed there, mm-hmm. Even in dissent. And those include his innate gifts, his genius, his literary gifts, his wit, his affability, his tremendous capacity for hard work, his devout Catholicism, and as I mentioned before, the extraordinary sacrifices of Maureen Scalia, who raised 9 children while Nino, her husband, was busy climbing the ladders of law, academia, and government.
James, let's talk about that first term, surprises and disappointments for Antonin Scalia. One disappointment is that these conferences among the justices were devoid of give and take. And I wonder if that's one reason why, perhaps just one reason why, the oral arguments became such a showcase for him. He couldn't satisfy those intellectual battles among the justices, and so he took those discussions straight to the lawyers involved.
So long before Antonin Scalia became a famous person or even became an appellate court judge prior to his tenure as a Supreme Court justice, as a student, high school student in the 1950s in New York, he appeared on a number of TV and radio programs, quiz shows, debate programs. No recordings of those appearances survive, but newspaper articles from the time recorded that Scalia often stole the show with his witty banter and his screen presence, if you will. And in fact, one of his childhood friends told me, and this appeared in the first book, that he would not see these on television or listen to them on the radio, but he'd come home and his father would say, "Oh, you missed Scalia this time. He really gave it to him this time." So by the time he was a teenager, Scalia had fans out there via electronic media. By the time he becomes a justice, a Supreme Court justice in the fall of 1986, there's no question that Scalia, as a student and then as a professor who appeared on a lot of AEI debate shows that were aired frequently on PBS stations across the country in the mid-1970s, there was no question that he had logged more time on television and radio than all the other justices combined, his 8 colleagues. And so he had a natural flair for showmanship. And in fact, he had been a student actor in high school and then in college. And so it was inevitable, I suspect, Scott, that Scalia's personality, his relish for debate, his instinct for showmanship and for the penetrating one-liner, would have led him to be a central, if not dominant, force in oral argument to the Supreme Court. But as you astutely mentioned, Scalia was very frustrated by the way that Chief Justice William Rehnquist ran the conferences, which are the closed-door meetings attended only by the justices where they announce how they intend to rule on specific cases, mm-hmm. usually about 2 days after they've heard the oral arguments in those cases. And Scalia got to the Supreme Court at the same time that Rehnquist had been elevated from justice, associate justice, to chief justice. Mm-hmm. So Scalia never knew at that time anything but the Rehnquist court. And having been a judge on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, the one rung below the Supreme Court and often described as the second most powerful court in America because its docket so heavily shapes the work of the Supreme Court and because judges from the D.C. Circuit are so often chosen to become justices. There, judges heard cases in 3-judge panels, and occasionally after those 3 judges would issue a ruling, there would be a demand for the circuit court to sit en banc, which is a French term that means the entirety of the court, so that maybe you'd get 12 judges sitting and then reviewing the ruling of the 3-judge panels. But those 3-judge panels on the circuit court are quite intimate, and Scalia got used to just walking down the hall of the circuit court to his colleagues, the other judges, people who were appointed by President Carter, such as his colleague Ruth Bader Ginsburg, for example, mm-hmm. or Robert Bork, who sat on that court, and others, and just kibitzing with them in their own chambers and talking about the cases. When he gets the Supreme Court, he finds none of that takes place. There is none of that easygoing collegiality. And Chief Justice Rehnquist, who had spent 15 terms on the Supreme Court as an associate justice, felt oppressed by the long-winded perorations that began conferences under the tenure of the previous Chief Justice Warren Burger. And when he got to be Chief Justice, Rehnquist was determined to do it very differently. So he kept the conferences moving very briskly. And Scalia was devastated to find that in these conferences, where he expected the same kind of give and take that he'd enjoyed on the circuit court with the judges there, that there was none of that with the other justices. And indeed, clerks from Scalia's first term on the Supreme Court told me that he learned the hard way, that you couldn't just walk down the hall and knock on the chambers of another justice and discuss the cases. They expected you to do this by memoranda in writing that were carried around by messengers and clerks. And all of this was kind of really deeply upsetting to Scalia. He loved debate. He wanted to get into the cases. He didn't necessarily go into the conference or even oral arguments with his mind made up. But there was none of that. And he wrote privately about his disappointment about this. And that's those letters, also previously unpublished, appear here in volume two.
That's James Rosen, the brand new book, Scalia, Supreme Court Years 1986 to 2001, the second part of his three-part biography on Antonin Scalia. More with James Rosen next. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Experience a wintry mix with the Shasta College Symphony Orchestra Saturday, February 28th at 7:30 p.m. at the Shasta College Theater. Enjoy music from Verdi and Beethoven and more, plus a melody from My Fair Lady featuring the outstanding winners of the Emerging Artist Solo and Area Competition. This special concert is sponsored in part by Vituity Anesthesia Reading. Tickets and information can be found online at shastacollege.edu/events.
This is Carl Bott. Join Linda and I Monday through Friday from 7 to 9 a.m. for Free Fire Radio. Find out what's happening in our town, our community, and our nation. That's Monday through Friday, 7 to 9 a.m. right here on KCNR, 96.5 FM and 1460 AM. Your talk radio. Miss a day, miss a lot.
At Plumas Bank, we understand business because we've grown alongside you in the communities we call home. We're proud to grow in Redding and excited to welcome Anderson and Red Bluff to the Plumas Bank family. With our new locations, your business gains expanded lending powers, more convenient locations, and more than 40 years of trusted community banking experience. Plumas Bank, building stronger communities. Learn more at plumasbank.com.
This is Ted Leidy with Northern Firearms Instruction. Obtaining a California concealed weapons license will allow the licensed individual to transport a listed handgun in their vehicle or on their person in public. For application instructions, training, and other information, contact NFI at 530-999-1822 or visit us online at usgunpro.com. This is Ted Leidy, and remember, it's our right and our responsibility.
Hi, this is Chuck Kinney, owner of Shasta Gas Propane. Have you been affected by some of the recent changes in business ownership here in Shasta and Tehama counties? These changes follow a national trend where national companies buy up locally owned small family companies and change the culture and staff and pricing of their product. That has occurred here in the North State also. Three locally owned propane companies have been purchased by large national companies. If you're like me and you prefer to deal with locally owned companies, you may be interested to know Shasta Gas Propane, which has been around for 28 years, now has the third generation working in the company. For locally owned, family operated service and care, give us a call at 530-365-3793. Thank you.
This Hawaiian mini vacation is brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. So what does professional office cleaning have to do with relaxing in a tropical paradise? Frankly, nothing. But Maui Bob and the crew want to remind you to be sure to take the time for what's important in this workaday world. Family, friends, and yes, even yourself. And if their professional office cleaning services can help you make that time, give them a call at 221-5868. This Hawaiian mini vacation was brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, 221-5868.
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram, talking with James Rosen. The second of three parts of his massive biography on Antonin Scalia is now out. Scalia, Supreme Court years 1986 to 2001. James, on that first term, there's some liberal writers who are watching and saying, Scalia, too loud, too ambitious, too aggressive. Are Scalia's bad manners turning his colleagues against him? And your reporting in new documents, new research in Scalia's Supreme Court year shows there's actually this clique inside the Supreme Court who are gunning for Scalia. What did you find?
This was really extraordinary, Scott. I'm glad you brought it up. And I have to credit the researcher who's an accomplished lawyer in her own right, who found these particular documents for me in the papers of the late Supreme Court Justice Harry Blackmun. Her name is Andrea Picciotti Bayer. But what she found was that before the Supreme Court decides to hear a case, they can't just choose any old case out there that they want to entertain. A case has to be presented to them, a petition for the Supreme Court to grant certiorari, which is abbreviated in a Latin term known as cert. When the Supreme Court grants cert, it means we're going to take the case that you're appealing from the lower courts. But they can't, one of those petitions has to come to them. Mm-hmm. And the way they decide, and so many petitions come to them that they delegate to the clerks, the mechanics of sifting through all the petitions, seeking cert, and which one should be granted, and in order for a case to be heard by the Supreme Court, the tradition is that at least four of the justices have to agree to grant cert. And in the back and forth between the clerks and between the different chambers where they decide which cases they're going to take, this researcher found that in the papers of Justice Blackmun, who was a liberal Supreme Court justice appointed by President Nixon, but who did a pretty hard 180 and ultimately became the author, for example, of Roe versus Wade. Mm-hmm. Someone who had no love for Scalia when Scalia joined the Supreme Court because Scalia as a professor had been so critical of Roe v. Wade in public, on television, in writing. Justice Blackmun and his clerks were taking notes on the cert pool memoranda being circulated by Justice Scalia's clerks. And they were using almost like a branding technique or a scarlet letter. Anytime one of those clerks belonged to what was then a fairly new group called the Federalist Society. The Federalist Society was founded with Scalia's help. In the early 80s when he was a professor,
right,
to establish chapters at different law schools of conservative students because they were so rare and they felt the need to band together. And of course today, as we know, the Federalist Society is probably the most powerful group of lawyers in America. And for the three Supreme Court appointments that President Trump made in his first term, they were all effectively selected by the Federalist Society. But Justice Blackmun and his clerks hated Scalia, hated the Federalist Society, and in their memoranda back and forth, the clerks with Justice Blackmun, they are insulting the Scalia clerks by saying, member of the Federalist Society. And not only does Justice Blackmun not ask them to stop doing that, he encourages it with snide little comments in his own handwriting that he's making on these documents. And this continued for years.
James, even early on during his time on the court, Antonin Scalia doesn't like losing, and he's tired of losing these cases to the more liberal majority on the Supreme Court. A friend and acquaintance, Jeff Shepard, talks to him and says, you know, your vote is great. We would love that we have your vote on the court, but we also expected you to perhaps influence these other justices on the Supreme Court. Later in Scalia's Supreme Court years, you talk about O'Connor and Kennedy and then Souter and describe them as becoming problems, that they are not becoming closer to Scalia in terms of ideology. Why was it that Scalia was less successful in either influencing or holding them closer to his point of view on some of the more high-profile cases?
So, first of all, Scalia was predicted when he sailed through Senate confirmation for the Supreme Court in 1986 by a vote of 98-0 that he would become a conservative version of the Supreme Court justice who was the most senior justice at that time, the liberal justice William Brennan. Mm-hmm. And Brennan was adept at building coalitions, securing a fifth vote to place himself in the winning side of cases. And Scalia, with his gregariousness, the fact that his Democratic colleagues on the lower court spoke very highly of him and enjoyed his company, it was suggested that he will become a conservative Bill Brennan. He will be a consensus builder. Mm-hmm. And that didn't turn out. And when Scalia would be asked about this in later years, his answer was, of course I wasn't going to change the minds of Bill Brennan and these other people on the Supreme Court, Lewis Powell or Sandra Day O'Connor. These are Thurgood Marshall. These are people who had been practicing the law and had been, you know, or sitting judges for years and years and years, and they had very elaborate thoughts about the law, and it wasn't as if I, Nina, with my great charm, was going to come along and change their views on the law. They've been ruling on these very issues in various permutations for decades. But the truth was, too, that, yes, Scalia's personality might have turned off some of the justices. The eagerness with which he took to oral argument, the fact that he soon became, even as a freshman justice, the most prolific contributor to oral argument, so that rubbed some justices the wrong way. But really what prevented him from building coalitions with the justices who were there when he got there was because he subscribed to a very different philosophy. Mm-hmm. And it's important that we've gotten to this point in our discussion, Scott, because what we're talking about right now, this is really why Antonin Scalia was not just one of the most important Supreme Court justices, but really one of the most important Americans of the last 100 years. When Scalia arrives at the Supreme Court in 1986, there is prevalent in American law a theory or a point of view that basically comes from the Warren Court, which was a very liberal court, and it's called the Living Constitution. This is the idea that the Constitution and its meaning should be something that judges today can expand as they see fit, like an accordion almost, like a breathing organism, in order to account for newer phenomena such as the internet or nuclear weapons that the founders never could have envisioned. And in Scalia's view, this idea of a living constitution whose meaning can be expanded by judges at their discretion really is just a judicial power grab. Mm-hmm. It is a means for which latter-day judges, particularly liberals, citing this living, expanding, breathing constitution, can modify the meaning of the Constitution or amend it to suit their latter-day policy preferences. Scalia's idea was that the Constitution is neither living nor dead. Rather, it was a legal document, and the terms that were enacted under it, as with any law enacted ever since, don't change. The words had meaning when they were adopted, and that meaning doesn't change over time. And if you want to account for newer phenomena, such as nuclear weapons or the internet, then you have a vehicle for doing that that's called a legislature. Mm-hmm. And you can enact new laws, and you can repeal existing ones. But you can't just say, well, that law meant X when it was enacted. Now, 10 minutes later, or 10 years later, or 100 years later, I, unelected judge, am going to tell you it means X plus Y, because I think it should. And at the time, originalism was a very lonely position on the philosophy on the Supreme Court. And that's the real reason why Scalia wasn't able to build consensi and to build coalitions.
Even more to talk about with James Rosen next. The book is Scalia, Supreme Court Years 1986 to 2001. More with James in a moment. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Now is a great time to prepare for the upcoming wildfire season. REU and city staff are busy clearing vegetation to mitigate wildfire risk to our power lines, facilities, and the community. You can also prepare by trimming back shrubs and tree branches that are closer than 5 feet from your home. Clear debris from your roof and gutter and clear dead vegetation on your property. For information about tree trimming and proximity to power lines, call 530-224-4356. Please remember, we all need to work together to prevent wildfires in our community.
Hi, I'm Steve Coburn, proud owner of Country Air Pet Resort here in Reading. I invite you to come and take a tour of my revitalized pet resort. Our goal here at Country Air is to make sure your pet can relax and have a healthy, happy time away from home. With friendly, caring people, lots of fresh air and exercise, good healthy food, and plenty of pampering. There are no small cages here. What we offer are large temperature-controlled runs and spacious exercise yards that are great for fun and socialization. We even offer daycare. Cats are treated to a two-room apartment plus playtime in our playroom. So stop by and take a tour of the best. You and your pet will want to come back to Country Air Pet Resort, where our motto is, we treat your pets as if they were our own. Country Air Pet Resort, 549-3335.
Is your garden ready to wake up from winter? Grange Co-op has everything you need at our Early Start Garden Sale, now through February 22nd. Spring is on the way, and we're celebrating with big savings. Take 40% off garden seeds, 30% off houseplants, and get a buy three, get one free deal on Rogue Poultry Feed. Whether you're planting new blooms or perfecting your lawn, Grange Co-op has you covered. Swing by Grange Co-op at 55 Lake Boulevard in Reading, or shop online at grangecoop.com to jumpstart your spring garden today.
Hi, this is Carrie Grawl. This season marks a new chapter for Organic Pilates, a rebirth of sorts in a new, larger downtown space. Alongside it, we want to introduce you to Harmony, a lifestyle boutique created as a natural extension of how we move and live with intention. We want to invite you in. Harmony and Organic Pilates, now open in downtown Reading. We're located at 1264 California Street in between Curated and Theory Coffee. We can't wait to see you.
Looking to grow your business locally? Get your message heard loud and clear on KCNR Radio, serving all of Shasta County. Whether you run a small business, a local service, or have an event that needs buzz, KCNR's trusted hosts and loyal audience can help your brand stand out. Affordable packages, custom ads, and a voice that delivers results. Advertise smart, advertise local, advertise with KCNR Radio. Visit KCNR1460.com or call 530-605-4565.
Now, this is Carl Bott
and Ted Leidy.
We want to invite you to our new show, Man Up, the fourth Thursday of each month, right here on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM.
Man Up, 6 to 7 p.m., where we explore the lost art of being a man.
Spirits, cigars, and hit the ground running when you get up in the morning. That's what Man Up's going to be about.
Oh, don't forget motorcycles, guns, and hard work every day.
And those things that men talk about when women aren't around.
That's right. Even cooking sometimes.
People, places, and things.
Serving your family, your community, and your country.
Man Up. Fourth Thursday of each month from 6 to 7 p.m. right here on Free Fire Radio.
We continue on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertrand. James Rosen is our guest, chief Washington correspondent at Newsmax and the author of Scalia, Supreme Court Years 1986 to 2001, a magnificent biography. James, we move forward in time a bit. The 95-96 term on the Supreme Court was very tough for Antonin Scalia. A lot of losses during the 95-96 term, a particular case, the VMI case, he was very upset about. And you report in the book that he was seriously thinking about retirement at the age of 60. And there's also this possibility that in my research, I find that John Boehner leaked around 10 years ago, but I did not hear about it at that time, that Antonin Scalia was at least approached, asked to think about being Bob Dole's running mate way back in 1996. How close did we come to losing Antonin Scalia on the Supreme Court in the mid-90s?
I think we came closer to losing Justice Scalia from the Supreme Court on the basis that he was bored and dispirited and was already 10 years on the great mahogany bench, believing as though he were repeating himself in his dissents, than we were to losing him because he felt inclined to accept the Dole team's offer of the number two spot on the presidential ticket that year. He considered it. And he ultimately consulted with his, what I call his Jewish consigliere, that's Judge Larry Silberman, who was his dearest friend over 40 years, who hired him at the Department of Justice in the 70s, represented him when he was up for Supreme Court confirmation hearings. And Silberman says to Scalia, "Would you like to return to the practice of law or to teaching, Nino?" And he goes, "No, why do you ask that?" He says, "Because Dole's going to lose. And if you serve as his running mate, that's what you're going to wind up doing." Silberman could speak in a very direct and unvarnished way to Scalia that nobody else could. He would sometimes address him as "you dummy." And I interviewed him extensively for this book. But yes, around the time of 1995, 96, you mentioned the VMI case. That was the case where the court held that the Virginia Military Institute could no longer ban female cadets from attendance and enrollment there. Scalia had dissented against that decision. He felt dispirited. And of all the people to write to him a little note to try and cheer him up was Harry Blackmun, who had retired from the Supreme Court by that point. And as I say, kind of had it out for Scalia. And so this book, Scalia's Supreme Court Years, contains a previously unpublished the response that Scalia sent to that nice note from Harry Blackmun. But I got to meet Scalia when he was 63, I should point out, and retirement was already a consideration. Early on, when he first got there in 1986, he said, "I'll do this about 10 years or so, because after that I'll be working for free." He could never really figure out what he would do next, and that's why he never retired.
I want to ask actually about, you mentioned Blackmun, but his relationship with Justice Brennan, in which Justice Scalia seemed to very much appreciate respect and want the respect returned from Justice Brennan. And you've uncovered a lot of correspondence in Scalia's Supreme Court years that says that Justice Brennan never really felt that way at all about Justice Scalia.
This is revelation in this book. In all the interviews I did for this book, and there are over 100 of them, with members of Scalia's family, 7 of his 9 children, members of what he called the clerkerati, these are the people, the 100 or so people, maybe 200 who served as his clerks, people who were friends of his, and all of them would say, would cite his relationship with Justice Brennan as being of a piece with his relationship with Justice Ginsburg, that here is a liberal on the court, and here's an example of the Scalia's great capacity for what William F. Buckley Jr. used to call trans-ideological friendship. Mm-hmm. And I had members of Scalia's family tell me about, extol the warmth of his relationship with Justice Brennan, and members of the clerkerati and others who were ardent defenders of Scalia. But I came across in the 1,100 boxes of papers and effects that Justice Brennan donated to the Library of Congress, one piece of paper, one letter exchanged between Justice Brennan and a reporter for the Wall Street Journal who had written a critical profile of Scalia, talking about how he didn't wind up as the conservative Bill Brennan. He turned out to be a loner, and he's ticking off his colleagues, and he's more often in dissent than on the winning side of cases. Mm-hmm. And Justice Brennan asked this reporter, Paul Barrett, then of the Wall Street Journal, to send him the article, which he did, and he wrote back to Paul Barrett, and again, this letter had never been published before, it's from 1992, and he states to the reporter, Paul Barrett, that his article, quote, says what so many think. And it's an extraordinary document because it shows that Justice Brennan, as Paul Barrett told me, based on his off-the-record conversations with Justice Brennan, took a very dim view of Scalia's role on the Supreme Court, considered it destructive, regarded Scalia's entire ascension to the Supreme Court as a juggernaut that had one goal in mind, and that was the undoing of Bill Brennan's legacy.
James Rosen with us, the book Scalia, Supreme Court Years 1986-2001. We have time for one more question. I have to ask about where the book ends, which is the Supreme Court action surrounding the presidential election in 2000, Bush v. Gore. And this is something where Scalia reminds us in your pages that he's somewhat amused by all the kerfuffle about this, because as he says, look, on the merits, the case wasn't close. It was 7-2 on the merits of the case. But he took a lot of heat, external heat, for the Supreme Court and what they did in Bush v. Gore. Your reporting shows that it was actually Kennedy, if I'm not mistaken, who was leading the charge on a lot of these matters inside the court. How would you describe and define Antonin Scalia's role in the Supreme Court action surrounding the 2000 election and Bush v. Gore?
At all points along this process, Justice Anthony Kennedy was taking the lead behind the scenes in keeping the other justices informed of what was bubbling up through the court system in Tallahassee and what was likely to arrive at the door of the Supreme Court. And he really fashioned the substantive arguments that were present in the final ruling by the Supreme Court, which halted the recounts in Florida and ended the litigation right then and there, a decision that effectively granted the presidency to George W. Bush, who lead in Florida 537 votes. The country had never seen anything like this. The idea that the presidency of the United States is going to be litigated to determine who gets to be president. Mm-hmm. And moreover, that it's going to be decided on the basis of a number of votes, the same number of people that could be fit inside a Texas roadhouse on a Friday night. And Justice Scalia, his role behind the scenes was that he felt that the Florida Supreme Court should be rebuked for ignoring the remand that the Supreme Court had sent down after the first case. Nobody took that idea up. But ultimately, it was Justice Scalia who issued a statement when the court decided to take up the Bush v. Gore case and hear oral arguments. He stated that the only reason this case would be taken, the only reason the justices would grant cert, is because there is a substantial probability that the Bush team will win here at the Supreme Court. And when that statement went out, a lot of people who were angry about the ultimate verdict were inclined to treat Scalia like he was the driving force behind it. Mm-hmm. But in fact, he didn't care much for the reasoning that was ultimately used in the Supreme Court's decision in Bush v. Gore. He used an epithet and called it, he said behind the scenes, in Brooklyn, we would call this a piece of you know what. But because he had been the intellectual leader of the conservatives for so long, it was just assumed out there by the public at large, by editorial cartoonists, by writers, by scholars, that he had to have been the driving force behind the scenes, and he really wasn't. But the reaction to Bush v. Gore was so controversial around the country that it changed forever the way Antonin Scalia was seen, and it changed forever the way the Supreme Court was viewed. Of course, in retrospect, after January 6th, the hoo-ha surrounding Bush v. Gore seems rather quaint, because after all, the verdict of the Supreme Court was accepted without any violence around the country, etc. But around that time, Scalia was walking through a tennis and golf club, and somebody interrupted him as he was walking to thank him for what he did in the case. And this is actually the ending of this book, of Volume 2, Scalia's Supreme Court Years, 1986-2001. He says back to this person, just a lawyer doing his work.
The book is out, Scalia, Supreme Court Years, 1986-2001. James Rosen, the author, chief Washington correspondent at Newsmax, also the author of the first part of this trilogy, Scalia, Rise to Greatness, and he will be the author of a third part of the trilogy. You can find him on X at James Rosen TV. James, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
You're so kind. Thank you, Scott.
Up next, we talk with Dr. Matt Meehan from Hillsdale in D.C. about restoring America's founding imagination. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
This is Judy Maxwell. Life can happen in an instant. Sometimes you plan for it, like retirement or taking care of your family. Sometimes it's a surprise, like a winter storm with home or property damage. Sometimes it may be an unexpected accident or illness or even a premature death. Whatever life throws at you, you'll wish you had gotten the right insurance when you had the chance. That's where Maxwell Insurance can help. For more than a quarter century, we've been serving the North State because it's our home, too. Give us a call at 221-0441 to let us help you review your policies and prepare you for whatever your future holds. Maxwell Insurance, 1378 Hilltop Drive, 221-0441.
Hi, Hi, everybody. McGraw Millhaven here, host of America at Night. Tune in each and every weeknight for Late Night Conversation. We'll have interesting guests, informative conversations from people who have been there and have done that. Plus, we always have time for you, the listener, because we love Late Night Conversations. Be sure to tune in every weeknight from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. for the next America at Night with me, McGraw Millhaven, right here on KCNR 1460 AM and 96.5 FM, your talk radio station.
A message from Todd with Reading Online Marketing.
Here's the truth. Your competitors aren't smarter, and they aren't better. Their marketing is.
Reading Online Marketing has years of experience and results backed by real data to put you on top. For maximum impact, ask about exclusive KCNR radio and digital marketing packages. Put your business everywhere your customers are.
We are local and can answer all your questions. Call me at 530-378-4060 or visit readingonlinemarketing.com.
Join me, Dr. Lauren, on Tuesdays at 6 p.m. behind the pink mic for breast cancer conversations about prevention and diagnosis to healing stories and words from expert guests. Behind the Pink Mic is proudly sponsored by Sizzle's Kitchen and Swell Endeavors. Tune in with Dr. Lauren every Tuesday at 6 p.m. on KCNR 96.5 FM, 1460 AM, and streaming at KCNR1460.com. Behind the Pink Mic, let's talk healing, hope, and community.
Join Aaron and Bill for We the People Radio, Sundays, noon until 2.
It's conservative talk radio with a liberal dose of humor. Get the whole story from experts around the world delivering facts rather than opinion.
Miss the show? Busy at noon? No problem. Listen to our free archives when you have time. No commercial interruptions or download restrictions. We the People Radio.
.us.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Check out the Hillsdale College Podcast Network at podcast.hillsdale.edu or wherever you find your audio, including YouTube. We're joined by Dr. Matt Meehan. He's Associate Dean and Associate Professor at the Van Andel Graduate School of Government at Hillsdale in D.C. Dr. Meehan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Talking today about some work you wrote for Heritage.org, Restoring America's Founding Imagination. It's part of their First Principles series. And I know part of this was in preparation of a new book that's coming out later this year, The American Book of Fables, that you have written. So looking back at the founding imagination, and I guess the American part of it, and the American part of the book, what makes a fable American, and where do we see that inside those stories? And maybe that's something we'll talk about later when we talk about the book, but let's start there with this conversation, too.
It's actually a great question, and the paper does sort of try to think that through. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like a good mixed drink, if you will. Like, there's a sort of mixology to the American fable, and it has component parts. It's biblical, mm-hmm. right? It's, or at least has a kind of echo effect of Christianity, like even if it's not directly about biblical stories, there's a kind of, oh, that's reminiscent of and deliberately laced in are echoes of scripture and the Bible. There's a very funny democratic wit where high things are brought low through humor and presuppositions are second guessed. And voices of correction come from all locations. Sometimes an ant on the floor before a bull. Or sometimes a bull will crash into a frog's life and stomp it and say no. But there's this sort of upending of hierarchies or something democratic and witty. Right? This sort of clever low comedy to it. And then there's something what I refer to as a kind of baptized stoicism. This very tough American sense that we are all going to die. And that means that we only have a certain amount of time to get after it. But it also means that because we're all mortal, we're all equal. And because we don't know when our end is, we must always be preparing.
Is understanding the founders' imagination different than just understanding their ideas or their principles, political principles?
Yes. So ideas are required, but every idea has to be implemented, and so there has to be a praxis, a practical implementation of it. And the way in which winds up being a very important part of what a principle is, right? Because I could say we're all equal. Like, well, the Marxists say that too. Right? So it actually matters. Oh, but there's a principle of nature. It's like, okay, but how do we implement these? How do they come into being?
Right.
And part of that's through law, but part of it's through custom. And so there's a kind of way in which. And one thing I learned from this study is how absolutely indebted the American way in which you do these things, you implement these principles, is Roman Republican in character. It is fundamental and foundational to everything they did. Their stories are rife with it. Quotations. It was the custom of the founding fathers in speeches and stories in their literature. They would not quote Seneca and Cicero because it would have been gauche. It would have been like saying, may the force be with you. That's episode 4, minute 27. You know, like, you just know. It's known. So much so that I think their imagination, their heroes, were Roman Republican most of the time. And then there'd be Greek additions, Greek enrichments, but it was fundamentally a kind of Roman Republican imagination.
You talk in this work about how Shakespeare and fables and stories help to give color to the virtues and vices in our lives. What happens to a society if it loses those shared moral images?
The short answer is they become moral infants. There's not moral agents anymore. What Shakespeare does, and in a certain sense, he combines all of these things. And I do think he's our national poet. People say America doesn't have a national poet. It's like, we do, actually. It's Shakespeare. Because I do think, and I would, you know, this is a much, I'll just open a can of worms and throw them on the floor and we can stomp them later. But Shakespeare's a Republican thinker. Shakespeare is trying to build up citizen wit for self-government. It's one of his deep projects for the English-speaking people. And we are the self-governing citizen republic that I think he was educating towards. And so we are in his debt as a poet that helped give the praxis that backs up and supports the principles that our founding fathers put forth and declared 250 years ago. And it's no mistake that right next to the Library of Congress and right next to SCOTUS, to the eastern back of the Capitol, is the Folger Library. And that's not a government building, but it's actually the people's poet that we put forward, raise the money, and have Shakespeare shown on Capitol Hill every night of the week. I mean, we just all the time as a regular thing. And that is, I think, a testament to Shakespeare. What Shakespeare offers is the kind of witty, wise account of self-government and tyranny. No one shows us more exquisitely, more clearly, with more depth and texture, both the evils of tyranny, see Macbeth, the complexity of tyranny through law, see All's True, or see Henry V, or see Julius Caesar even. But Julius Caesar is a special case because it also shows that even honorable people who are seeking liberty and self-government can destroy it. And that's Brutus, et tu Brute. So I think Shakespeare is sort of, he's a godsend for the American Republic.
The founders drew from Bible and Greek and Roman history, Shakespeare, as we talked about, fables. Do we have anything comparable today that's shaping the imaginations of young Americans?
So there's, right now, it's basically a kind of Byzantine cathedral, right? There's all kinds of art, but it's all sort of niched and alcoved. The national art, the popular national art, is very poor. There are little elements, like you could say, like, try the Marvel Comics superhero universe, right? The Avengers. Captain America has some aspects of, you know, the old American civic, etc. But it's kind of like you need to be updated. You know, like it's maybe a little, you know, not quite sufficient to the task, etc. So there are aspects interwoven into the wider pop culture. But generally speaking, what I'm seeing, and it's actually a big concern. It's why I'm writing this book, The American Book of Fables. There is a lack of attention to the kinds of imaginative, formational images and ideas that basically commend Republican self-government to the hearts of men. That's missing. And instead you get a worship of people that, frankly, icons and role models that the founders would have found abhorrent.
If it's not the American Book of Fables by Matt Meehan, is there something else or some things else that we should be looking at to help reform this healthy civic imagination and find that founding imagination once again?
A lot of good books that are sort of early imagistic versions. The Action Bible?
Have you seen that? Yes. My son just devours it.
All of my kids. It's phenomenal, right? Like there's so much good in that book. You know, and like everyone's faith tradition might want to take an eye and filter, like, I don't know if that's exactly right, but basically, like, yeah, grow up. You can do that with your kids. Just mind it. But it's a great book. I think that there's a lot of repackaged, like Tintin's back.
Yes.
The Hardy Boys are back. The old ones that didn't get sort of weirdly sort of mopped up into the sort of teen sensuality. There's a lot of representations of the old Mother Goose editions.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of good, but it does take some discerning to find it these days.
Dr. Matt Meehan is Associate Dean and Associate Professor at the Van Andel Graduate School of Government in Hillsdale, in D.C. He's the author of Restoring America's Founding Imagination over at heritage.org, part of their First Principles series, and the upcoming book, which we'll talk about soon, The American Book of Fables. Dr. Meehan, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you very much, Scott.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to James Rosen, his new book, Scalia, Supreme Court Years 1986 to 2001, and Dr. Matt Meehan from Hillsdale in D.C. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews, like James Rosen this week, or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at podcast.hillsdale.edu or wherever you get your audio. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Are you looking to take your business to the next level? Don't let staffing issues or HR red tape stop you from growing. The most successful businesses are those that have mastered their HR and staffing needs, and they have done it with O2 Employment Services. Finding qualified help is harder and more expensive than ever. HR regulations are getting more and more complex and confusing. For over 20 years, O2 has been providing the foundation successful businesses need to grow, assisting employers with their HR, payroll, workers' comp, benefits and staffing. Partnering with O2 gives you the expertise you need to manage your business and employees. Outsourcing your HR and staffing is no longer a luxury. It's a necessity for successful businesses, and it is more affordable than you think. Let O2 show you how we can help you reduce your HR complexities, hire the right talent, and get back to growing your business. Call O2 today at 530-223-4674 or visit us online at o2es.com.
This Hawaiian mini vacation is brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. So what does professional office cleaning have to do with relaxing in a tropical paradise? Frankly, nothing. But Maui Bob and the crew want to remind you to be sure to take the time for what's important in this workaday world. Family, friends, and yes, even yourself. And if their professional office cleaning services can help you make that time, give them a call at 221-5868. This Hawaiian mini vacation was brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, 221-5868.
Linda Fott. Join me for the first Thursday of every month at 6 p.m. from my show, North State Now. In this one-hour show, we cover what's happening in the music scene, theater, food, and arts. We get in-depth interviews with local business owners, musicians, actors, and authors. Listen in, tune in, call in, participate. Win tickets to concerts and theater productions. It's a lot of fun, and believe me, it keeps us going. Join me, your host, Linda Bott, or North State Now, the first Thursday, right here on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM. Also streaming at KCNR1460.com.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.